Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the U.S. Defense Secretary continues his tour of India. Five people are detained in the nation after hundreds of people are killed or injured in a massive fire.
They are employees of the firecracker unit which had manufactured these firecrackers, which were stored by the temple.
Political pressure is on the rise to tighten financial rules in the United States. And the soulful pop band Lucas Graham touches a nerve with music. It's all ahead right here on The Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter is in India during a wave of increased cooperation with India's military. Traveling with him is correspondent Carla Babb, who joins us by phone from New Delhi. Hi there, Carla.
Hi, Susan.
I should tell our listeners a little bit of a lag here between you and me, but we'll work it through, okay?
Okay.
The Defense Secretary tipped the administration's hand a bit today by talking about when President Barack Obama meets with Gulf partners in Riyadh. What did he have to say?
Well, he actually said that the political and economic progress is very important to making the campaign against the Islamic State a success. He said that the president would be looking to ask the Gulf partners to help contribute to rebuilding Iraq, because he said that that is what is necessary to make the defeat against the defeat of the Islamic State stick, he said. He also mentioned that the United States planned to help the Iraqis accelerate the military campaign as fast as they possibly could.
Today, the defense secretary was visiting with U.S. and Indian forces. How did all that go?
That was quite an interesting time. The secretary actually spent some time on one of the aircraft carriers of the Indian fleet. And then he went and spoke to some of the troops of the USS Blue Ridge. That's part of the U.S. 7th Fleet, which is the largest Navy fleet that we have in the Asia-Pacific. He mentioned how important it was to be there and to protect the sea lanes in the Asia-Pacific region, pointing out that about 90% of all trade that's done across the globe reaches the sea at some point. So it was a very interesting day. I know that they have been talking, the secretary and his officials with him have been talking with their Indian counterparts on trading technology. There have been talks about aircraft carrier technology when he was on the aircraft carrier, because, you know, the Indians, they have an aircraft carrier that has a ramp that helps to build the seat up for the planes to go in the air. The United States, on the other hand, has this advanced technology that has a catapult that can help the airplanes get in the air faster and easier. And so the Indians are very interested. And I was speaking to an Indian official who said they are looking for a third aircraft carrier in around the time frame of 2028. So sharing this technology is very important to them.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Carla, and have a good trip there.
Thank you.
Police in southern India have detained five people for questioning in connection with the temple fire in Kerala that killed about 100 people and injured 380. On the line with us from our New Delhi bureau is reporter Anjana Pasricha. Welcome, Anjana.
Hello, Susan.
What do we know about how this fire started, Anjana?
Well, you know, the temple, which is in southern India, in the southern state of Kerala, had organized a massive fireworks display. This was to mark the start of the Hindu holy year. It was part of a week-long religious festivities. So the fireworks display began around midnight on Sunday, and it was going on for about 3 hours. Then at around 3:30 a.m., apparently, one firecracker landed on a building where a massive quantity of firecrackers had been stored. There was a huge explosion, a massive fire. The building caved in, so did part of the temple, and apparently huge blocks of concrete flew all over the place. So there was this blaze, and then there was a stampede. People tried to flee the fire. Many of them were trapped inside the temple. And that's how many people, of course, succumbed to burn injuries, while others were injured due to the huge blocks of concrete which fell on them, which apparently flew into the air as far away as a kilometer.
I understand the Indian Prime Minister has visited the disaster site. What has he had to say?
Well, the Prime Minister, of course, offered all assistance because to the state from federal funds. He visited with a team of medical experts because hospitals in the state of Kerala are overwhelmed by the huge number of victims that have come in. He went to a local hospital. He saw the victims. He met the victims there. And he offered also to fly some of them out to Delhi or Mumbai if they could not get the treatment that they needed in the state itself.
Who were these people that were detained?
Well, five people, as you said, have been detained today. They are employees of the firecracker unit, which had manufactured these firecrackers, which were stored by the temple. Apparently, some of the people at the temple trust are on the run. They are not to be found. But cases will be booked against all the people who organized this fireworks display, which actually had not been given permission. It had specifically been denied permission to hold this fireworks display because there have been similar accidents previously, though, of course, not on this scale.
Is this sort of fireworks display typical for this kind of occasion?
Absolutely. That is why I think they had asked for permission. But a lot of the residents had said that this is dangerous. This is, a difficult thing. And that's the reason why the district administration had specifically refused permission, because typically what happens is there are thousands of people who gather for this display and it becomes difficult to control and to ensure public safety.
Are any outside supplies coming in to help the injured and to help the survivors?
Well, I haven't heard of any outside help as yet, but of course the Indian Armed Forces have been also at the forefront of a huge relief and rescue efforts. They've ferried ships there. This is a coastal area. They took in helicopters to try to, and this was a small town, to try to fly out the people who were injured. They will also be taken to naval hospitals, to Air Force hospitals, because I think one of the major problems at this point of time is to actually give adequate treatment to the number of people who are injured. Many of them are very critically injured, and there are about, apparently, the latest figures tell us that it could be close to 400.
Well, thank you very much, Anjana, for speaking with us.
Thank you, Susan.
Time for a look at what's being said on the web today, and I'm joined by social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew. This is kind of a very serious story.
Absolutely. A lot of grief, anger, shock, all of those emotions that you see after these kind of tragedies being expressed on social media by the general public. And we're seeing a lot of images as well of, you know, the fire as it's happening. We're seeing video, short video, being shared on social media, and then the aftermath as well, the rescue, and then even photos, the day after. So lots to more to come, unfortunately, out of that case. We'll see if that death toll rises as it's expected to.
And meanwhile, we've got the Secretary of Defense over there, also in India.
We do. We have Secretary Ashton Carter is over there. And something I saw that I thought was an interesting parallel between the Pentagon press secretary and the India Ministry of Defense spokesperson, both of them tweeting out photos of Secretary Carter's visit at different points, from the welcome dinner to speeches to different people. So I thought that was a cool parallel between the two of them, that these are the two spokespeople for these respective countries' ministries of defense, but they're both kind of doing the same thing and using social media in a similar way. Similarly, the Department of Defense also tweeting out photos of Secretary Carter, as Carla Babb was talking about, as he spoke to some of those U.S. troops.
And meanwhile, we have some bigwigs over there as well.
Some other bigwigs, and in fact, the ones that are maybe capturing more attention are Prince William and Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge. They're over in India as well. Lots of photos of their trip.
Very well received.
Very well received. Of course, anytime that any British officials go to India, of course, those two countries have a long history. It makes big news. But for two as photogenic as these two, It's no doubt no surprise that they're getting a lot of attention, a lot of photos, a lot of video as they make their way through the country.
As they do wherever they go.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers from Vanderbilt and Harvard universities have discovered a binary star system nearly 10,000 light years from Earth, where it takes 69 years for one of its stars to eclipse the other. But once it does, the eclipse lasts for 3.5 years. The researchers described their findings in a paper that's been accepted for publication in the Astronomical Journal. This star system, which has no official name, has set a new record for having both the longest duration stellar eclipse and the longest period between eclipses in a binary system. Until this discovery, the previous record holder was Epsilon Origae, an eclipsing binary system that is only 2,000 light years from Earth. That star system's yellow giant star is eclipsed by its normal-sized companion, that's slightly bigger than our sun, for 640 to 730 days every 27 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The release of the so-called Panama Papers and efforts to control the funding of terrorism are boosting political pressure to tighten financial rules in the United States. Senior economics editor Jim Randall joins us here in the studio to talk about the issue. Welcome, Jim.
Well, hi. Glad to be here.
Thank you. What sort of tightening is being proposed for finances?
Well, one thing is that there are a lot of anonymous corporations set up in various countries, and that it's a long, convoluted explanation, but basically it helps bad guys hide the origin of their money or the way the money is being moved or hides it from taxes or hides the destination, which is a real problem if you're financing a terrorist organization.
And so what are they proposing be done?
They're proposing that ending the anonymity in these LLCs, in these corporations that are chartered in many countries, and they're saying there needs to be rules. Carl Levin, former senator, U.S. senator, who has been working on this for years and years, and he wrote an article in the paper saying, you guys, we've been talking about this for a long time. We need to do it. We need to end the anonymity, and we need to make it clear who owns what. This will make it harder, not impossible, but harder for drug dealers to hide the origin of their money or for terrorist groups to hide the destination of their money.
Or for politicians in the Panama Papers getting involved in these offshore banking.
Yeah, to hide their wealth from taxes or just hide their wealth. The political damage has been not so much that these guys have been caught doing things illegally. They've been caught doing things that the voters in some cases think are hypocritical, you know, talking about frugality and then talking about keeping money in the home country that they're trying to run and so forth. And in fact, having large offshore accounts, that's a political landmine for a politician.
Are economic efforts to control financing to terrorist groups causing collateral damage?
Yeah, there's some unintended consequences. There are a lot of charities that are actually legitimate. They're raising money for the people in the most damaged and difficult parts of Syria and some other very difficult places that are under sanctions and so forth. And the banks have paid huge fines for violating sanctions laws, and so they see these relatively small accounts, and they're not going to make much money on them, and they're at risk of these massive fines, and so they're just, you know, in many cases, just arbitrarily just closing these accounts, saying, we don't have anything to do with you guys. And so that's causing some real headaches.
Well, isn't it always really tricky when you adjust these financial rules? Can it sometimes cause, like, financial havoc, especially with stock markets? You know, you
surprises.
Mention rules and the stock market goes way up or way down. Or
uncertainty, surprises, stability is what investors want. They want predictability. And so if they telegraph the moves well in advance, saying we're going to tighten up this rule, we're going to change this method of doing business, we're going to change this, investors are fine with that. And what investors think matters, because if they invest their money in things that grow, that create jobs, that create wealth, that's good for the economy, and that means jobs and so forth. If they're frightened, if they're uncertain, and they're reluctant to invest, that slows economic growth. And since the population is growing, we need to create more jobs to keep up with just the natural growth. So predictability is what they really need.
It dawns on me that this is really a global problem, though. If the United States does things, what about all the other financial institutions around the world?
That's why you have these international financial organizations that try to get together and coordinate all kinds of rules, and so that you have more or less one set of rules, and you can figure that out, and then you can figure out if you're going to have a chance of making a profit in this country or that country doing this or that. And predictability, again, is something that they really like. And it's tough because there are different cultures, different economies, different ways of organizing the economy. It's a lot of work.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Happy to be here.
Coming up on International Edition, a U.S. author looks back to look forward in U.S. politics. And the song, 7 Years, touches a nerve. We'll be right back. There was a time in America when politics worked, to quote a release from publisher Basic Books. It says, in the 1960s, when Lyndon Johnson was president, the U.S. Congress passed more than 1,000 pieces of legislation collectively known as the Great Society. Randall B. Woods has written a book about this era called Prisoners of Hope, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Randall.
Thank you, Susan.
Why do you believe things worked back then in the United States?
Lyndon Johnson was one of the least partisan presidents in American history. When he was Senate Majority Leader, he led the Democratic majorities in Congress and insisted that they cooperate with the Eisenhower administration rather than trying to obstruct. When he became president, that paid off. And in fact, in the 64 election, he got more Republican votes than Barry Goldwater did. And in that day and time in Congress, people were not surrounded by large entourages. They knew each other personally, and even people on the opposite end of the political spectrum had respect for each other.
Are today's Democrats and Republicans still fighting over the same issues as they did 50 years ago?
Absolutely. Part of the Voting Rights Act was passed in 64, and of course the Supreme Court has moved to cut back on its guarantees. The Immigration Act of 1965 did away with the national origins basis of immigration policy, and of course, immigration is a major debate today. Part of the Great Society was the passage of Medicare and the government's role in health guarantees is a major topic today with Obamacare. Federal aid education was part of the Great Society, and we're talking about standards today, so it just sort of goes on and on.
Well, how can the actions of the Johnson period be applied to the current race for the White House?
Well, I think that in many ways the Democrats since the 60s have distanced themselves from Johnson and even the Great Society because of Vietnam. Liberals were completely turned off by that. Hillary Clinton is the only presidential candidate ever to have mentioned Lyndon Johnson's name in public. And that's probably fitting because her brand of liberalism really represents his brand of liberalism. That is, equality of opportunity, job training, regulated capitalism, bipartisanship, and that search for political centrism is really under assault from both the left, Bernie Sanders, and from the right.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today, Randall.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Danish singer-songwriter Lucas Graham Forshammer has broken through with his hit 7 Years, which recently reached number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 music chart. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the soulful pop band Lucas Graham has touched a nerve with the song.
Once I was 7 years old, my mama told me, go make yourself some friends or you'll be lonely.
Lucas Graham Forshammer says he always wanted to release his pop soul music in the United States. He had success in Europe and in Australia, but it wasn't until the hit 7 Years that the Danish-born singer saw his dream come true.
I've always wanted to release in America. That's where I believe the music belongs. The style and the eclectic musical mix that we've put together kind of belongs here. this is where most of the genres are from, all the rap and soul and rock and roll, most of it anyway.
Forshammer grew up in Christiania, Denmark, a self-governed neighborhood in Copenhagen known for Pusher Street, where dealers peddle marijuana. But it also has a tight-knit community, and he and his boys, bandmates Mark Lovestick Falgren on drums, Casper Dalgaard on keys, and Magnus Magnum Larsen on bass, are currently on a North American tour. Lucas says he wants to touch audiences with his music, and he can see from the stage when a song affects someone.
Like when I make people cry when I sing 7 Years or Better Than Yourself, Happy Home, You're Not There, all these big ballads about loss and pain and family and experience and life, I'm like, that person gets it. And if someone's not crying, I'll be like, okay, so that person hasn't gone through that experience yet. Give her 5 years. She'll get it. Eventually, everybody gets it.
The 27-year-old Danish singer says that the song 7 Years wasn't intentional. It grew out of a recording session when his producer was just playing some chords on the piano.
Rizzy Rizzy, my main producer, started playing the piano. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And I just started singing, once I was 7 years old, my... And then he was like, well, that's good, keep going. And I'm like, once I was 7 years old, my mama told me go. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's good. And we just 3.5 hours later, the song was done.
Lucas Graham Forshammer studied law before deciding to pursue music. He says his experience growing up in Christiania made him want to make a difference in people's lives. But now he's doing it with his music. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Navy announced this month that it had seized a ship laden with illegal weapons in the Persian Gulf that were likely bound for Houthi fighters in Yemen. It was the latest in a string of illicit weapons shipments seized in the region by naval forces and assessed by the U.S. to have originated in Iran. Distributing illegal weapons is part of a pattern of destabilizing behavior by Iran that remains a challenge for the United States and its regional allies. In testimony before Congress, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Thomas Shannon said the United States has been encouraged by Iran's adherence so far to the commitments it had made under the nuclear deal with the P5+1, the JCPOA. But he noted that profound differences with Iran remain and continue to be addressed.
Iran's support for terrorist groups like Hezbollah, its assistance to the Assad regime in Syria, and to Houthi rebels in Yemen are at odds with core U.S. interests and pose fundamental threats to the region and beyond. That's why we have retained our sanctions related to Iran's destabilizing activities in the region, including its support for terrorism.
In addition, Undersecretary Shannon expressed concern over Iran's attempts to develop increasingly capable ballistic missile systems and said the U.S. would use all available multilateral and unilateral tools to impede the development of Iran's missile program. Iran's violations of the fundamental rights of its citizens were also cited by the undersecretary, who noted that rights-related sanctions are not subject to relief under the JCPOA, and the U.S. continues to vigorously enforce these sanctions. At a recent press conference in Bahrain, Secretary of State John Kerry urged Iran to change its destabilizing behavior. We call on Iran, said Secretary Kerry, to prove to the world it wants to be a constructive member of the international community and contribute to peace and security, and to help us end the war in Yemen, not prolong it. Help us to end the war in Syria, not intensify it. And help us to be able to change the dynamics of this region, which needs space to begin to breathe, to engage in full economic activity, put people to work, send people to school, do things other than constantly be caught up in the instability that comes with either sectarian or ideological extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.